Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg. Last week on Route 51, we looked at the issues in the August 12th Democratic Party primary for Northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. And today, we switch to the Republican ballot for a discussion with Don Rahala, who is challenging incumbent Congressman Sean Duffy as he seeks to gain a third term in the 7th District. Don Rahala is a real estate broker and property manager from Superior, who ran for the 7th District Congressional seat once before, back in 2010, when he was a candidate on the Democratic Party primary ballot. After his defeat, he endorsed Sean Duffy in the general election race against Democrat Julie Lassa. Now he's running against Duffy because he says Duffy hasn't been tough enough or consistent enough on the national debt. Sean Duffy, he says, has disappointed the people of the 7th District in, quote, what matters the most, our future. For the next hour, we'll be asking Don Rahala about his positions on the issues, about why he ran on the Democratic Party ballot 4 years ago and is now running as a Republican. We'll ask him why he is so disappointed with Sean Duffy after endorsing him in 2010. And you can ask him, too. Don Rahala will be taking your phone calls for the next hour at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment or a question for Don on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Don Rahala, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Glenn.
And do you mind if I call you Don?
Yeah, sure.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself for people who aren't familiar with you and your business and your history in Superior.
I'm from Superior. I'm 46, single, never married, no kids. Went to school, grew up here, went to high school here, graduated college 1990, got a BA with a dual major in accounting and finance. I was an accountant in customer service, sales, project management, and now I'm a real estate broker and do property management up here with my own company.
Tell us about your family.
I come from a middle-class family. They're all engineers. Don't ask me why I'm an accountant. My uncles, my dad, my brothers, they're all engineers. I decided to be an accountant, I guess. But, yeah, I got a couple of nephews and nieces, and I myself am single, so I'm just living a single life. So.
Well, why are you running for Congress for the second time?
Well, it's basically the same as the first time, only it's a little more relaxed. This time around, I feel that the first time around, I wasn't quite happy with Dave Obey. You know, Dave Obey was in office for 41 years. That was a little too long. So I think eventually someone was going to come out anyway and challenge him. But Sean Duffy beat me to the punch in 2009 he came out. He had $1 million right off the bat, so I wasn't interested in running as a Republican then. Back then, I ran. I was all set up. I had my website set up. I had all my issues. I put a lot of work into it, and I just went on the Democrat ticket as a conservative message. It's basically the same message, different website. A lot of the issues and the beliefs I just cut and paste from one side to the other, and nothing really changed. So
the reason you ran as a Democrat back in 2010 was because you didn't want to face that $1 million war chest that Sean Duffy had amassed?
Yeah, I might be foolish, but I'm not stupid. So.
And then after the primary, when you were defeated by Senator Julie Lassa, you turned around and endorsed Sean Duffy for Congress. Why did you do that back in 2010, and why are you running against him now?
Well, in 2010, Sean Duffy, I mean, we were under Dave Obey for 41 years with his ideology and, you know, his beliefs. Sean Duffy came out with a different message, a very conservative message. I'm a fiscal conservative. I've never said that I was a Democrat in 2010. I've always ran as a conservative with, you know, I'm from Superior, so superior 70-30 Democrat-Republican. So I do have some Democrat leanings, we'll call. We'll talk about those later. But, you know, deep down, I am fiscally conservative. When I lost to Julie Lassa and Sean beat Dan Mielke, I endorsed him. You know, he called me up. I gave him that endorsement in the last week anyway. I don't even think anybody saw anything because I never went, you know, mm-hmm. It was never published or anything like that. It was just on my website. So it was kind of an after-the-fact thing.
So you endorsed him because you thought Sean Duffy was more in line with your conservative principles and
right, my conservative beliefs, right?
Well, this time around, you're running on the Republican ballot against Sean Duffy, who wants a third term. How has the official 7th District Republican organization reacted to your campaign?
Well, I was actually friends with, I'm not going to say friends, but I was chummy with the district chair, or the county chair, in which he became the district chair, Craig Rosen. Yeah, you know, he thinks it's silly, you know, so, but, you know, Sean Duffy is not, he talks a good talk. In 2010, I jumped on his bandwagon. After 4 years almost, you know, it's not, he's not performing consistently as a conservative, and I think that's where the problem falls in line.
Well, aren't you worried that this split in the Republican Party, and it's not just the 7th District, but all across the country we've got conservatives challenging incumbent Republicans from the right, and the perception is that it weakens the Republicans when you go into the general election. Aren't you concerned that challenges like yours could hurt Republicans in the November election?
I'm not concerned about that. I think the Republican split is just as big as the Democrat split. On the Democrat side, you have environmentalists clashing with the union guys that want good jobs, and the environmentalists want to protect the environment. Of the case in point, the mine coming up here. With the Republicans, you have the hard right. Well, I wouldn't even call it the hard right. You have the traditional Republican Party, which, you know, that's why all these candidates like me are coming up. You know, we don't care for the John McCains or the John Boehners or the these old Republican ways. You know, I'm not a Tea Party candidate, but I have more conservative values, and I believe that the only way we're going to solve this is being consistent. You can't solve anything when you're inconsistent in office, and that's what's going on now. Just because we have a Republican House, you would think that, well, everything would be nice in coming out of the House, you know, perfect. But it's not. It's coming out. It's not even coming out. They're not even bringing votes to the floor because the leadership in the House is so bad. And that would be John Boehner, and he's one of the old-time, you know, Republican Party guys that I very much disagree with.
Well, the theory is they're not bringing those votes to the floor because they want to block President Obama's agenda, what they call a liberal agenda, at every turn. You can't be opposed to that, can you, if you're running as a conservative?
Well, I'm not. I believe he does have to be blocked in a lot of things, quite frankly. But this political gamemanship that's going on is just, it's unacceptable. I mean, you can't. That's why they say Congress's rating is, you know, 3-10%, somewhere in that range. I mean, it's ridiculous. Why are these guys even in office if they're just going to stand back and let Obama use his pen and his cell phone to dictate where this country goes?
Well, there is a new Associated Press poll that just came out, and it finds that nearly 9 in 10 Americans say that they disapprove of how Congress is handling its job. 6 in 10 disapprove of President Obama. More than half of the Americans, 54%, disapprove of both. Is your campaign tapping into that discontent and anger?
It is. I'll tell you what, Glenn. I'll tell you this quick story. Both times in 2010 and 2014, I went out there and got the majority of my signatures. This time around, I got 1,100 signatures. And when I go knocking, I go talking too. So out of 1,100, I had the same spiel. I said, well, especially for people that wanted to say no to me, I turned around, I said, well, what do you think about John Boehner? And I saw that grit, and even the hardest Republican that didn't like me and they loved Sean Duffy, they had that grit in their face, and that got my foot in the door. And I said, well, let's keep talking about John Boehner. And they usually would take my clipboard and sign my name, or sign their name and give it back, you know. And that, they just wanted me gone because they didn't want to talk about John Boehner. Two people, might I add, two people out of 1,100.
Do you think
that they loved what John Boehner was doing?
do you think John Boehner isn't being tough enough on President Obama? Because when you talk to Democrats about John Boehner, they'll tell you that he's buckling into the Tea Party and the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and he's blocking the president at every turn. So there's like a disconnect in how people see John Boehner, depending on, you know, whether you're a conservative or a liberal.
Right. I see John Boehner when I see him teary-eyed and crying and not being able to, I don't know if I can say that, not being able to have the testicles to get anything done. I mean, he's just, it's like he's playing the game. At some point, you've got to do something. You've got to bring some legislation to the floor, even if it's a one-page long bill. He's not bringing anything. And that's part of the big part of the problem here.
Now, let's look at what you say on your website anyway is your main beef with Sean Duffy. You don't think he's been tough enough on the deficit and the national debt. Explain that to me.
Okay. When bills do come through, like this appropriations bill in January of this year, the appropriation bills of 2014, Sean Duffy and the majority of Congress, this is a bipartisan bill. They were more than happy to sign this bill. It was the same bill that shut down the government in 2013. They were more than happy to get it out of the way. And guess why? The reason why? Because they have elections. They have elections to win this year. They don't want to talk about the debt ceiling. There's always talk about the debt ceiling and deficit spending. This year, there's zero talk about debt ceiling and debt spending, even though we're still running the same deficits.
Well, I had a chance to interview Sean Duffy a couple of days ago at an appearance in Wausau, and I asked him about your concern, your view that he isn't being tough enough on the debt and the deficit. Let's listen to his response, and then I'll have you respond to it.
All right.
Listen, I've been part of a team in Washington that are advocating for balanced budgets. And I now sit on the budget committee with Congressman Paul Ryan, and we have proposed budgets that'll balance in 10 years. And we reform the way that America spends. And, you know, I think you have to have the right balance. If some would say, well, I want to do it not in 10 years, I want to do it in 5 years or 3 years. That's possible, but there's some people that can get hurt with drastic changes too quickly. And so I want to make sure I have a reasonable approach that can accomplish the goal of balancing our budget, but also do it in a timeline that makes sense for the American people. And I think I've struck that balance with the budgets that I voted for. So maybe Don wants it to be more extreme than that, but, you know, I think we've struck the balance.
So Congressman Duffy says he's striking the right balance. He's working with Paul Ryan to cut the deficit and balance the budget responsibly. And he says your position is more extreme than that. What's your reaction?
That's interesting. I guess I do see his point. I mean, you don't want this big massive bubble we created. You don't want that to be collapsing down and shutting down the economy and all that. But guess what? At some point, you have to start saying no. They can talk about this Paul Ryan bill all they want. That ain't going to happen in the next 2 years. So they have to start doing other little things. You can't just keep, like in January and the previous years, you can't just keep passing this stuff. You eventually have to say no and take some kind of concessions. You know, whether it's cut 1%, 2%, something has to be cut here. And I haven't seen any of that in 4 years with Sean Duffy. I think he's afraid to say no. I don't know why. But he needs to start saying no.
How do you feel
to his vote to John Boehner?
How do you feel about shutting down the government in order to make a point about the deficit?
My point is if every congressman started saying no, which they didn't, then things would get done. I mean, obviously they said no and the government shut down. I mean, the non-essential services were shut down. I don't know. Maybe we need to have non-essential services shut down for a while. In my district, I didn't see anybody complaining that this shutdown was affecting them that much. So,
well, let me quote a famous Republican for you, former Vice President Dick Cheney, who said while he was in office, "Deficits don't matter." Ronald Reagan proved that. That's what Dick Cheney said.
I have never heard that quote, but they obviously do matter. This is real money. I mean, we're talking $17.5 trillion now. I'm sure we're going to be at $20 trillion by the time President Obama leaves office. And that's unacceptable. At some point, we're going to have to pay this back. And it's not going to be me and you. We're old farts. You know, it's going to be our kids and our kids' kids and the kids' kids after that. So,
you know, many economists, Don Rahalas, say the worst thing you can do in a major recession or an economic downturn is to cut government spending and balance the budget. The government, they say, needs to step in, needs to stimulate spending, start public works projects, and create jobs. The argument is that's how we got out of the Depression.
The last part again?
Oh, the argument is that's how we got out of the Depression, with President Roosevelt's public works projects. Put people back to work, spend money, run a deficit.
Right. So spend more money and get further in the hole. I mean, I've done the math all I can. It doesn't make any sense. At some point, you have to start paying it back. And we can't even get to that point where we even start cutting a little. So we're adding entitlements, we're adding all kinds of new stuff when we don't have to. Why are we doing this? It's like we're on a path for destruction. It's like it's meant to happen, and I don't quite understand that.
Let's move to talk about something else that Congressman Duffy and the House majority of the Republican Party did just earlier this month. They voted to sue the president because, according to Congressman Duffy, Mr. Obama has overstepped his authority in executive actions. Here's what he said 2 days ago when I talked to him.
The president first has wide latitude in protecting the homeland. This is different, though. What the president has done in many different executive actions is step into domestic policy. I'll give you a few examples. Number one, the work requirements in the 1996 Welfare to Work Reform. The president has unilaterally, not going back to Congress, but he's changed the work requirements under that law and rewrote them through regulation. Another example is we have federal laws that say it's illegal to sell drugs or it's illegal to bank drug dealers. The president has changed those congressionally passed laws signed by presidents to allow Colorado to actually sell marijuana and not go after those drug dealers federally. And he's also trying to change law so those drug dealers in Colorado selling marijuana can actually bank through the U.S. banking system. If you're going to change those laws, you have to go back to Congress. You just can't unilaterally, as a president, suspend or waive laws, and that's what he's done. If the president can suspend or waive any law, you've undermined the whole legislative process. And we don't want to see a Democrat president do that in Barack Obama, but I don't want to see any executive do that.
That's Congressman Sean Duffy talking about the lawsuit filed against the president. Don Rahala, how do you react to that lawsuit?
You know, these lawsuits don't go anywhere. They're going to get to court, some judge. They're going to find the right judge that's going to throw it out. So I think this goes in line with John Boehner's leadership. This is all he feels he can do instead of controlling the spending. The spending originates in the House. So I don't know why he's just not shutting off the spigot of money. When you do these lawsuits, you know, they can get caught up in court for months and months and months, and still at the very end, some judge, they're going to find some judge somewhere to throw it out, and it's not going to make a hill of beans of difference. So
some Republicans are saying that the lawsuit doesn't go far enough, that the president should be impeached. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do. Getting back to lawsuit, by the way, Ron Johnson's lawsuit got thrown out. So that's what I mean by it's just going to get thrown out anyway. As far as impeachment, absolutely. Sean Duffy could have kept on talking there. He could have gone on and on and on what President Barack Obama is doing. He's not acting as a three-party system. He's acting on his own. And Sean just gave, you know, just a few of the examples of President Barack Obama acting on his own. With an impeachment, even though the impeachment wouldn't stick, at least it would bring to light to the people of the United States exactly what this president is doing, exactly what Sean is saying about what this president is doing. That has to come to light because the majority of people, I'm going to say the majority, they don't pay attention to what's going on in Washington.
Well, Don Rahal, Republicans voted to impeach Bill Clinton back in the 90s, and it backfired in the congressional elections. They lost a lot of seats after they did that. Aren't you worried that that would happen again?
I'm not worried. When I look at what Bill Clinton did to get impeached, it's not even comparable. Bill Clinton lied to a grand jury. This Barack Obama seems to be lying on a daily basis. So I don't know why they're waiting for it. Yeah, you know, and again, I think it's a knowledge thing. You got to educate the people on why they're being impeached. They haven't made that case yet, so that's why that will probably never happen either. And then they got to stick with these silly lawsuits that aren't going to get anywhere.
Well, House Democrats are using that lawsuit against the president and the talk of impeachment to raise a lot of money right now. According to Politico, and I'm going to quote from an article that just came out yesterday, they say it's working better than anything Republicans have tried so far. Last week, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee raised $4.8 million thanks to the lawsuit and the talk of impeachment. So, some people would say by talking about impeachment, you're playing right into the Democrats' hands.
Right. Well, it is, after this time around, Glenn, I can tell you it is all about the money. you have to get out there to get your message heard, and I knew right off the bat and June 1st that this is going to just not be a good year for me. So you need that money. You need that campaign backing. Sean has $1.5 million, and he's able to get his face all over the district.
And how much does Don Rahala have?
Not enough to worry about filing with the FEC.
Let's. One of the reasons that Mr. Duffy indicated that he wanted that lawsuit filed, he says President Obama should be enforcing the marijuana laws in Colorado and Washington State. How do you feel about that?
On my website, you're going to see that I'm pro pot. I mean, you have to. It's coming whether you like it or not. It's already in, I think, 25, 26 states. Does it have some medicinal qualities? Of course it does. Can it be abused? Of course it does. It still has to follow the rules, say of alcohol. And, you know, you can't be using marijuana and go out driving and expect to live that kind of lifestyle. You still have to have, you know, restrictions. But
so you're saying that Colorado and Washington State should be allowed to sell recreational marijuana, even though it's against federal law, and the president is okay not enforcing that federal law?
I would say it needs to be regulated, but yeah, I think marijuana, you know, they say it's a gateway drug. I know people that have used marijuana since high school and they're still on marijuana. I mean, it's, you know, and they're productive, by the way. They all have jobs. I don't know any burnouts that are just, you know, with a tin cup on the corner looking for money, so.
One of the other points that Duffy made about this lawsuit, it involves Obamacare. They were pointing to his decision not to enforce or actually delay the individual mandate.
Right.
Talk about the Affordable Care Act. The most recent polls indicate that it's unpopular, but the majority of Americans now say we need to keep it and improve it and not scrap it.
Right. Well, I think the Democrats, a couple months ago, if you could look that up, they were actually saying it needs to stay as a whole. You can't piecemeal this thing, and you can't. Now government subsidies are in question. So you can't subsidize one state and not subsidize the other. So once that falls, then the whole thing's going to fall. Right now the CBO is saying $2.7 trillion over 10 years, and that in itself does not make any sense. We're already running huge deficits. Why are we going to add, you know, that much more for something that doesn't make sense? And secondly, and for me the most important, and probably for 50% of the people out there, the Obamacare squashes your First Amendment right of freedom of religion. Right now, as it stands right now, your taxpayer money is subsidizing someone else's abortion. I'm not going to say I'm lax, but I have a kind of a lenient stance on abortion. I think that's God's job to figure that out. If somebody wants to have an abortion, Go have it. You know, we can talk about other things later on that, but if they want to have it, go have it. I don't want to be attached to it. I don't want to be paying for it. I don't want to be subsidizing it. Keep me out of that loop. You know, this is a small battle that pro-lifers need to win.
But the Hyde Amendment mandates that no federal money can go for abortion. And Democrats and people who favor the Affordable Care Act will tell you that it does not subsidize abortion.
Yeah, the Hyde Amendment was thrown out. That was thrown out a long time ago, a couple of years ago. Just because you take money from your left pocket doesn't mean it's not coming from the right pocket. So that's what it's the same pool of money. And of course they're going to argue that, but that's not true. It's your taxpayer money is subsidizing abortion right now.
How do you feel about the court decisions which say that private companies through the Affordable Care Act can deny contraception coverage for women?
Well, Hobby Lobby?
Yeah.
Hobby Lobby is a very, it's a very religious, the ownership of Hobby Lobby is very religious. So in a sense that it's not a publicly traded company, I think that based on the ownership of that company, I think they have a case there where they can, they're the ones that are actually paying for the birth control. So I think they have a say in that.
We're talking to Don Rahala of Superior. He is a real estate broker and a property manager, and he is running for the 7th Congressional District seat for the second time, running against Republican Sean Duffy on the August 12th ballot. If you'd like to talk to Mr. Rahala, if you've got a question for him, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on our Facebook page, and I'll read it on the air. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can, too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum. Summer exhibitions feature 20th century printmaking, from New Deal era lithographs to Andy Warhol's pop art screen prints, on view through August 24th. LYWAM.org.
I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio as we talk about the August 12th Republican primary, and that is coming up next Tuesday. Our guest is Don Rahala, who is running on the Republican ballot against incumbent Sean Duffy. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-800-780-9742. Don, yesterday Rob Mentzer of the Wausau Daily Herald wrote a column about long shot candidates. I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
Oh, no, I missed it.
Well, he lumped you in with Mike Crisine, running as a Democrat in the 7th District, and Brett Hulsey, who's running against Mary Burke in the governor's race. He writes about you and the others. This is a quote. "They're not going to win. They are such outsiders that the casual observer of the political scene would be forgiven for missing the fact that they even exist."
Now, that I disagree with. I think if you're going to vote in this country, you need to know at least who's on the ballot. So a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of people will say that, they went to the ballots in 2010 and saw, oh, there's another guy, and maybe it's a male. Let's vote for this guy instead of Dewey Lassa. Maybe that happened, maybe it didn't happen. But, that's not excusable. You need to know what's on your ballot before you go to the poll.
We're giving you an hour of time on Wisconsin Public Radio, just like all the other candidates. But Rob Mentzer in that column also writes that you sent out an obscene tweet using a four-letter word for excrement to describe the ignorance in Wausau, and he's got a link to it. Do you regret doing that? Do you regret doing that?
That's me. Yeah, you'll see a couple of those words in my website, and I'm not a nun or anything like that. So, he's talking about how the ignorance in Wausau politics.
And please don't use the words on the air, because
<I'm not. laughs>
I could lose my job if you do that. But like you said, there are a number of four-letter words, swear words, on your website. Aren't you concerned that you'll alienate social conservatives and evangelical Christians with that language? I know a number of them who just don't like swearing.
We're saying the S word. We're not saying, harder for four-letter words, but I'm just trying to keep it real. I'm angry about this stuff, and sometimes it comes out, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, that's just me. When I type that thing up, I mean, sometimes something would come out. So
don't you think that you might lose some votes, and maybe if you cleaned up your act on that web page a little bit, you might be able to get more votes in the primary?
I think I did think of that. I thought I'd probably gain more than lose some. So I think people read that, you know, it's not horrible, by the way. It's just, you know, it flows with conversation, and sometimes when you talk to somebody, they throw out an S-bomb. I mean, that's all it is. It's nothing more than that.
All right. I don't want to spend any more time on it. last week on Route 51, we looked at the issues in the 7th Congressional District Democratic primary. Now, if you win, you'll face either Kelly Westland of Ashland, who's endorsed by the Democratic Party, and also by former Congressman Dave Obie, or her conservative challenger, Mike Christine, who's hoping for an upset. I'm going to play what they had to say about the minimum wage, Social Security, and income inequality in the U.S., and then have you react to that.
Over the last, you know, 30 to 40 years, we have seen corporate profits increase steadily. We have seen the gap between the very rich and everyone else increase. At the same time, productivity's gone up, workers are more educated than ever, and yet workers' wages have remained stagnant. It is wrong in a country that has so much access to tremendous wealth to have people who work full-time still struggle to make ends meet. When we raise the minimum wage, we're putting money back into the pockets of people who don't currently have disposable income. We're putting money into the pockets of people who will spend it and help drive economic growth for the middle class. As far as the social safety net, programs like Social Security and Medicare, these are things that were put in place to help keep people out of poverty. And if the goal of government is to fight inequality, then these are tremendously important programs. Social Security is the most effective program at keeping seniors out of poverty that we have. And if we were to lift the cap on Social Security, it would be solvent through 2050, if not beyond. In this country, the 900 wealthiest people stop paying Social Security taxes after day two of the calendar year. I think that's wrong. I think that we can do better than that.
Mandating through government that the way businesses conduct their operations is bad.
Would you eliminate the minimum wage altogether?
At the federal level, yeah. I mean, the federal government has no
control. What about at the state level?
State level, I think we've got 50 states. A laboratory of experiments type approach would work great. See what happens. See which states like to do what. And if people don't like it, they can move from state to state. If people don't like it in the federal government, we got to leave the country. So way too much federal control over the economy.
Your reaction to her suggestion that we eliminate the cap on Social Security taxes?
Social Security is dead, as far as I'm concerned. Social Security, right now, our expenditures are 12% above what we're taking in. That cannot go on forever. There's only so many wealthy people in the nation. I haven't run the numbers, but you cannot continue to labor these people who are actually kicking money into the economy, creating jobs. You know, both the minimum wage, you start jacking the minimum wage in here, you start increasing taxes on the people that are producing the jobs, and you're going to have people that are going to be put out of work.
That's Mike Christine, who is running a conservative challenge to Kelly Westland in the August 12th Democratic primary. Don Ray Hala, your reaction to what they just said about Social Security, does it have to be preserved at all costs because it's the only thing keeping elderly people out of poverty, or is it dead? Is it a lost cause, which, as Mike Christine says, should be phased out?
No, it does need to be preserved. I think there's half the people in the United States here have zero retirement rate here right now. So I think it has to be preserved. It's a program that was started, you know, a couple decades ago. I think if we got rid of the stuff right now that's creating all these problems, all the current deficit spending, the current programs, and got rid of some of those, I think it would stay intact. It does need to be tweaked a little. I mean, we are running, like Mike said, at 12% over cost, so that obviously needs to be fixed, but yeah, I think it does need to be preserved.
What do you think of Kelly Westland's idea of removing that cap on Social Security taxes so a billionaire would be paying the same percentage of his income on Social Security as a dishwasher? Right now, after I think $100,000+, you know, the Social Security taxes get phased out.
Yeah. No, I mean, on an individual basis, you're paying into Social Security, then that's your retirement pool. Is that same billionaire entitled to a Social Security check once he hits retirement? You bet he is, but no more than he put in, and that's what he's putting in. So I understand where she's going with that, and it doesn't make that much sense. I mean, I'm sure if Democrats were in power, you know, had majority in the chambers there, that something like that would pass. But I don't think that's the way to go about it.
So you're in favor of keeping the cap as it stands right now?
Yeah, for an individual, right?
Right. And are you in favor of raising the minimum wage? Polls indicate a significant majority of Americans want that to happen.
Yeah, the polls are one thing, but the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, what they say is another thing. And even President, if you're a Democrat, even President Obama has said that the CBO is the official scorekeeper here. The CBO says anything over $9, anything over $9, then you start losing jobs. At $9 an hour, you lose 900,000 people gain, like Kelly Weston's talking about, but 500,000 lose their job. And that's unacceptable. That's an unacceptable trade-off. Does the minimum wage need to be tweaked? Sure. It hasn't been bumped in a while. Yeah, bump it up. A lot of these states are coming through with their own bumps, so maybe that's the way that it's going to, you know, come about that way at the state level.
Are you concerned at all about income inequality in this country, where, according to statistics, the gap right now between the richest and the poorest is greater than at any time since the Great Depression?
I'm not a rich guy, so I look at that, I'm thinking, well, there's always been rich guys. I mean, these guys are the guys that take the risks. You know, maybe a lot of them, they inherit that money and then they build off of it, your Rockefellers and, you know, whatever. But, yeah, you know, I think that just, it should set a tone that, you know, if you want to get somewhere in this country, you gotta continue with your education. You gotta do a good job to get anywhere. And that's what's, you know, when you just give somebody an increase in the minimum wage, if you were to give them a $3 bump right now, there would be no lesson learned. Then they'd be looking for the next bump up to $12 an hour. I mean, so a little concerned, but now on.
Even Wall Street apparently is concerned about income inequality, and they're saying at least one group, Standard & Poor's, says that the income inequality is negatively impacting the growth of our economy. They just released a study yesterday with the title "How Increasing Inequality is Dampening U.S. Economic Growth," and they've actually downgraded their predictions for future growth of the American economy because the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest, they say, is too high.
Right. Well, when you talk, if you talk about it on a whole, you can have all these different variables come into it. I like to look at it on an individual basis. If you want to go anywhere in this country and you've got plenty of opportunities, you've got an education up till age 18, and you're on your own from there. But you've got to work hard in this country to get anywhere. And the education doesn't stop, whether it's at 18 or whether it's at 23 or 24 after you're out of college. You have to keep advancing to stay on top of everybody else. And that's just what gets lost when you mandate automatic bumps in income. So, in wages. So,
one of the big issues facing us right now is the border crisis to the south, with all of these immigrant children streaming across the border. Let's listen to what Sean Duffy had to say, and then I'm going to get your reaction to it.
We have children who are coming from Central American countries that are going on a horrific journey. I see the pictures. I hear the stories. Little girls are being raped. Little children are being maimed on the way. They're being beaten. We're seeing pictures of dead children in the desert, dead children floating in the Rio Grande. That we would have American policy that would encourage children to go along this journey and experience the kind of pain and anguish and sometimes death is unacceptable. So this is what I think we need to do. The children who get to the border, we need to take care of them. We need to make sure they're healthy. They've been on a long, horrific journey. Many are sick. Take care of them. And then I think we have to have law changes so we can quickly process them and get them back home to their countries of origin, to their moms and dads, where I think children belong. And if we do that, if we can get them back home quickly, that sends a message to these Central American parents that what you've heard about amnesty in America isn't true for your children. Don't send them on the dangerous journey. Don't pay the $6,000 to $9,000 to the drug dealer or gang member to shepherd them to the U.S. border, because it will be for naught. They will not get that amnesty. If we don't start sending some of the children home, this is just the start of the crisis. You're going to see future waves of children coming to the American border because they think they'll get amnesty. And more children will die, more girls will be raped, more children will be maimed, and that's not the right policy.
Don Rahala, reaction to what your Republican primary opponent, Sean Duffy, said about the immigration crisis.
100% agree. That's all I can say.
All right. Well, let's look at where you stand on other issues. And Democrat Kelly Westland entered politics in part because of her opposition to the iron mine that's been proposed for the Pinoki Hills south of Lake Superior. How do you feel about that?
I think the mine, I'd like to see it move forward. There's mines all over this country. Why is this one any different? There's the same concerns in other states. This is nothing new. We've done mines in this country before. Let's get it done. Let's put these jobs out there. These are well-paying jobs. Some say up to 1,000 well-paying jobs, and that's what's needed in that part of the state. Of course, it has to be done smartly, though. You got to respect the environment and treat the environment right, and I think that's doable. It's doable in other states, so I don't know why this state is any different.
What about the opposition of the Bad River Tribe and the other Indian tribes who almost unanimously oppose that mine? Bad River says it's in ceded territory and it poses a threat to their wild rice beds. That makes it a federal issue.
Right. And, of course, that's going to get into the courts. So that's up to the courts to decide if this is in ceded territory. But again, this is the same, these are same mines that are going across the country. I live in Superior, it's right next to Minnesota. They've got the Iron Range up there. You know, I've hiked and biked and fished in these old mine pits. I mean, they're beautiful. They're like mini, tranquil lakes, you know, out in the wilderness. During the mining process, I'm sure it's, you know, it's a messy job. You're disturbing the earth to pull out, minerals, but, after they put it back to where if they put it back to the way they found it, I don't think there should be an issue. And they protect the environment on the process of doing this. There shouldn't be that much of an issue.
What about energy policy? Coal, nuclear, natural gas, alternatives like solar and wind. What kind of a mix would you like to see?
Right now, Wisconsin, well, most states beat what the EPA mandate is. In Wisconsin, it's 10%. They're up to 10% now with renewable energies, and I think that's pretty fair right now. And I think that's fair, and I don't think we can go any further, because once you go beyond 10%, then you don't have a reliable energy source, meaning that if, you know, you got 10,000 people throwing on their air conditionings, you're going to have problems, because solar and wind, they can't keep up with that kind of demand, whereas a coal-fired power plant can, or nuclear, that is, both of those can. So I think 10% is a good mix. It's already here in Wisconsin. I won't want to see it go any higher unless there is an incredible advancement in technology for these other energy sources. And right now, as it stands, it's not. So it's like you could invest millions and billions of dollars right now, but you're going to be stuck with an old IBM computer, you know. It doesn't make sense to invest that kind of money right now.
What about, you know, maybe having the federal government get together with private industry and do a Manhattan-style project in order to push renewals, in order to see how far we could go with solar energy and wind energy and some of these other options,
right.
Maybe even fusion. You know, we did that to create the atom bomb back in World War II. What if we did that for alternative energy?
Right.
I talked to Republican, Bob Culp, a state representative, and he said that he would consider something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going on right now. We just don't know about it. I mean, that's something that, innovation spurs the economy, so... whether these companies are doing it on their own, you know, I'm not sure. I don't see behind their top secret doors of what they're doing, but hopefully that's coming right now. Alternative energies right now are very, very expensive, and whether people know it or not, you can pull out an electricity bill from today and pull one out from 4 years ago. You're going to see a spike in your kilowatt hour.
Are you Don Rahel, are you concerned about man-made climate change? I've heard predictions that the Northwoods in the foreseeable future will have the same climate as northern Missouri. We'll have droughts. We'll have more floods in other parts of the country. Are you concerned about that?
No. I mean, am I concerned about protecting the environment? Sure, absolutely. Am I concerned that there is this man-made climate change going on, you know, with the UN scandal of hiding data? No, I don't believe that. I don't believe in that theory. So I think they're all computer-generated models based on this and that of current trends, and I don't think it holds water.
You know, I work for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're the educational arm of the University of Wisconsin. I don't know of any climate scientist employed on any of our campuses who doesn't believe that climate change is real and serious and at least caused in part by man.
Right. That's probably because they all got fired when they opened their mouths.
Don Rehala, he's our guest on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. He'll be with us for about another 8 minutes or so if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-780-9742. He's running against Republican Sean Duffy in next Tuesday's August 12th primary.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Greenwood Hills Country Club, Wausau, helping the community one round at a time with Make a Difference Mondays, a day open for all golfers to enjoy a round of golf while benefiting a Wausau area charity. Details at greenwoodhillscc.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Don Rehala, a Republican candidate in the 7th Congressional District next Tuesday, August 12th. Is the primary. Don, we're running out of time, so I'm going to let you set the agenda right now. Is there anything that I haven't touched on that you'd like to talk about?
And now you put me through the ringer, so I think
oh, I haven't. It hasn't been that bad.
I'm loving your court. It's your show.
All right. Well, let's talk about foreign policy. We've got all kinds of problems right now. We've got Israel and Gaza. We've got Islamic group taking territory in Iraq. We've got Ukraine, Crimea, Russia, atrocities in Syria. Everything seems to be falling apart at once. Do you blame the president for that? And what would you do in order to address some of these issues? Do we have to send military troops in to some places?
Okay, let me start with that last one and work our way back. No, we need to stay the heck out of the Middle East. That doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense, you know, 9 years ago or 8 years ago, whenever that was. And it certainly doesn't make sense now. You know, we're losing too many lives over there. People, you know, our boys are coming back all maimed and injured, and it's just not a winnable cause. You know, the Middle East has been like that for thousands of years. Why do we think we can change it? It goes for Afghanistan too. The Russians were there first; they couldn't do it. So why do we feel we can do it? We still have the strongest military in the world here. We need to keep that strength, not to dominate the whole world, but we need to make sure that our military level is as strong as to fend off the biggest army that can come against us, and that would be probably China.
How do you feel about foreign aid, and how do you feel about trade agreements? And I'm sorry, but you've only got a minute. We're running out of time.
Foreign aid, cut that back. I think we're up at $60 billion in foreign aid. That's money that could be spent at home, and that's money that needs to be spent at home. Trade embargoes or trade pacts, I think they're somewhat good, but it has to make sense where the United States is more of a beneficiary than, you know, than a hindrance to it. So.
What are Don Rehala's biggest priorities? Let's say you pull off what some people would consider a miracle. You actually win this primary, and then you go on and win the general election. It's your first term. What are your priorities as the new congressman from the 7th District?
I call that my David Brat moment, if that happens. It can happen, too. David Brat defeated Eric Cantor, you know, and that was a David versus a Goliath. Sure, it could happen. Sure, absolutely could happen. I'm open to all ideas, you know. I spent a lot of time getting these signatures, and that's the exact same approach I would do. I would just blanket this as best I could as a congressman and get all the inputs that I can, keeping it honest and open, you know, for conversation. Getting in Congress without an agenda and voting consistently as a fiscal conservative. I think everybody's actually fiscal conservative. At some point in your life, you've made a fiscal conservative decision, whether it's buying a house or a car or running a business. So everyone's done it. So.
And if you could accomplish just one thing in that first term, what would that be?
Again, when you say an accomplish, I'd like to see it progress from where we're at right now. Instead of running these unbalanced budgets, I'd like to work forward to ending that, but when you say an accomplish anything, do I intend to go there with an agenda? I do not. Congressman is one in 435 congressmen. If every congressman came to Washington with an agenda or some kind of a goal, you're not going to get that because you're going to get, you know, 435 people button heads wanting it their way, and I'm not like that. I'm willing to sit back in the first year, as all freshman congressmen do, and go from there, make the right votes, and go on from there.
Don Rihalla, thank you so much. It's been an interesting and an informative hour. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
And we do want to thank today's guest, Don Rihalla, who faces incumbent Congressman Sean Duffy on the August 12th Republican Party primary, 7th Congressional District ballot. That's next Tuesday. The winner of that race will face either Kelly Westland or Mike Crisine, the candidates on the 7th District Democratic Party primary ballot. You can find out more about Don Rihalla's candidacy on his webpage, donforcongress.com. That's donforcongress.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of this show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 o'clock on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Don't forget to vote next Tuesday, August 12th. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.